You're listening to the Fertility Docs Uncensored podcast, featuring insight on all things fertility from some of the top-rated doctors around America. Whether you're struggling to conceive or just planning for your future family, we're here to guide you every step of the way. Today's podcast is brought to you by Ovation Fertility, a leader in the field of IVF lab services. Ovation partners with some of America's leading fertility specialists to provide a range of services to support fertility treatment, including fertility testing, IVF, egg donation, surrogacy, genetic testing, and long-term storage of reproductive material. You can learn more about Ovation at ovationfertility.com.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Carrie Bedian from the Fertility Center of Las Vegas, and I am joined by my stunningly radiant, beautifully gorgeous, intelligently phenomenal co-hosts, Dr. Abby Evelyn of Nashville Fertility Center.
Hey, everybody.
And Dr. Susan Hudson from Texas Fertility Center.
You know, the only reason I do this is for the ego boost from Carrie Hope, because she is like the queen of adjectives.
No matter what you say, it's always an ego boost.
Well, I feel like both of you deserve it on a regular basis, and none of us ever gets the love that we need.
I like that.
More love is never the wrong answer. And so we are also joined by the amazingly brilliant and charming Daniel Madero, who's essentially the director of everything at Ovation Fertility. And so we have come across him in the course of the association that we have with the lab. And just in talking with him, he's got a phenomenal background and has been in this fertility space for many, many years. And so
literally his entire life.
Literally his entire life. And so we were just chatting beforehand. We were like, oh, like what, you know, outside of all the fertility stuff, What do you like to do? And Daniel, you said that you collect hobbies. And then so that kind of launched us into all the things. But you mentioned that you do triathlons and races and all those things. How did you get into that and all of that? And we are so glad to have you here.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. My pleasure to be here. And thanks for that introduction. That is indeed an ego boost. How did I get into it? The real story is that I was at a party with a friend of mine. We were just talking about, you know, doing something different. And on the spot, we decided to sign up for a triathlon. And it wasn't just any triathlon, half Ironman. Oh, I had never done anything.
You started with a half Ironman?
Yes. It was jumping into the deep end, basically, literally.
Were you a swimmer or a runner or a biker before all of this decision-making happened?
No.
So he had as much experience in triathlons as we had experience in podcasting when we started this.
Which is about zero.
So how did that first one go?
Terribly bad. I didn't plan for it too well. I did some training, but I got married the week or 2 weeks before that.
Oh, wow.
So I stopped my training. And when I went for it, it went really bad. After it, though, I was stuck to it. And this year, I've finished 2 triathlons. And I'm now doing the shorter distances instead of going all in with the 70.5, which is 70.5 miles of exercise.
So, Daniel, I've never done a triathlon before, but I know people who have. And so what I hear is that my friend who's done them before said, you know, running part's not bad. The main part that she really dreads is the swimming part. And particularly, she's done a couple where she's had to swim in the ocean as opposed to like a lake or something. Have you ever done one like that? And is that your experience too? Do you hate the swimming part, or is that a cool part for you?
Actually, that's one of the parts that I enjoy the most. It's usually the most difficult because there's a lot of kicking and punching.
Yeah.
Because you're in the fray and everyone's around you, and you know, you're trying to kick them and pull feet. I've had people pull me and try to push me away. So I might imagine that might be the case. But for me, it's the most peaceful part, aside from kicking and...
If you get away from the fray, it's the most peaceful part.
Yeah, but it's so beautiful just swimming out in the open ocean, in my opinion. A lot of people dread it because you don't know what's below you as you're swimming and you can't see the bottom. But as you're swimming, you enter into this rhythm where it's 1, 2, 3, 4 breath. When you're biking, the bike tends to be the longest part of the whole triathlon. So it's harder to get into rhythm. First, you're just out of the water. But for me, the part I dread the most is the run, because you're already
But that's what you end with.
The least dangerous one. You're not going to drown. You're not going to fall off your bike at, you know, 20 miles an hour. It's just running, and you're going to faint to the floor.
So where has been your favorite triathlon that you've done? Either the prettiest place or the most fun route that you have been on?
I have to say one of the nicest ones I've done was here in New England in Cape Cod.
Oh, that'd be pretty.
So you're swimming out in open ocean. It's very cold.
Ooh.
Very, very cold, but it's beautiful. And then you're biking on rolling hills and you're on the run on the beach, basically. So it was a very scenic route. So I would say it was one of the most beautiful ones.
You've hung up your triathlon days, you said?
No, I'm still training. Yeah.
You did two this last year?
I did two this last year, which is, I wanted to do more, but then, you know, I started a new job, so.
Yeah, you've got a lot of hard work.
We appreciate it. You joined the Ovation team.
Yes. So I've been, I kind of paused it, and right now is the off season. So during the off season, you do more
cross training,
weightlifting training, exactly, cross training, but you're preparing a good base.
So what's your ultimate goal? When are you just trying to do as many as you can, or do you have a certain goal? Do you want to do a certain number in a year or a certain number overall, or
improve overall? I think bringing down the times and then increasing the distances is one of the fun parts. As you see your time go down, you just want to go do more and do better. And by the time that, you know, you're doing Olympics, you are thinking, okay, I might be able to do a half Ironman.
You jumped right in with that one.
Right in. So I would say my goal is for next year, you know, given COVID and everything else, but probably do an international 70.5, which is the half Ironman destination. So go either to Mexico, some, you know, nice beach town, and then just enjoy part of the experience as well as relax somewhere new.
Abby, I have heard that the Nashville half Ironman is actually one of the friendlier ones that's out there. Yeah. And I think it's because
really a
decent chunk of it is downhill. And so, you know, in all of your spare time, you could start with that one too. And you could jump in just like Daniel.
Yeah, Daniel, come to town. We'll show you around. We'll let you have some fun in Nashville. Let you experience our good cooking and our bars and our music, you know?
No, Abby. Abby, you should do it. You should jump in with Daniel. He can help you train.
Let's go.
Okay, Carrie, I've run a half marathon, but that's about it. And the only biking I do is on a Peloton. So,
I mean, but that's a good start. Like,
you already have like 66% of it already.
Exactly.
So you just need to jump on a pool and done.
All you have to do is not drown. And that's supposedly the easy part because it's downhill in the river that you go down. And so,
but if I didn't do well at that part, it could be really bad though. If I drowned, that could be really bad.
We'll get you Fertility Docs Uncensored floaties that you can wear in the Ironman.
Hey, Daniel will be swimming by and like kicking me and my water wings will be flying. Well, I'll think about it, Carrie. I'll keep it on my bucket list. How's that?
That's okay. I'll keep reminding you just so you don't forget, you know, because that's the kind of friend I am.
Okay. I'll keep that on my bucket list.
Susan, do you have a question of the day for us?
I do. Okay. Our listener says, I am 32 years old and have had one failed IUI, two egg retrievals yielding 3 PGT normal embryos. First retrieval, they got 42 eggs. And the second retrieval, they got 29 eggs.
Wow. That's a lot.
Had one failed frozen embryo transfer. Doctor says that I have unexplained infertility with poor egg quality. We now have 2 embryos left, a day 6 and a day 7, and aren't sure whether we should do another frozen embryo transfer or do another egg retrieval while I am still under 35 years old. Next step is to do ERA testing, but after that, we aren't sure how to proceed. Any advice? So I first of all say this is not unexplained infertility.
Yeah, I mean, she didn't get a ton of normal embryos, but she's got normal ones. And if you've got normal ones, that's 3 is about what the average person gets. Not over 2 cycles, however, but still.
And not at like 70 eggs, you should have more than 3 normal embryos if you have 70 eggs retrieved.
Right. But I think too, when you make those kind of eggs, that is none of them do real great. I think there's a sweet spot for egg number. If I were this patient, I would definitely, I mean, I guess it depends on what her goals are for having children. But I mean, if she's got, I think she said 2 left now, is that right?
Mm-hmm. a day six and a day seven.
Yeah. So maybe not as good.
Yeah. I mean, I think that in the some of the studies that we have done looking at egg size, we have not actually found a correlation between a larger yield of eggs at egg retrieval and poor quality. Like the babies that you get end up being good. I don't know. I mean, I wonder if there's some utility in perhaps checking a karyotype. I actually just had this conversation with some of our embryologists where a similar story of a patient, bunch of eggs, easy stim, like mild doses of medication yielded a ton. And there was very poor egg quality. Ultimately, like the eggs came out, were mature, fertilized, got to the day three stage without any issues. But when they made blastocysts, there were a ton of blastocysts, but there was no intercell mass on any of them, which is what ultimately becomes the baby. And so not helpful there. And so the conversation that ensued after that was like, all right, what do we do? How do we help her? And we're talking about doing a karyotype because one of our embryologists had that situation twice. And in both cases, the woman had a surprising abnormal karyotype. When that test was done, and there was no history of recurrent pregnancy loss. So there was no reason to get it ahead of time. But he said that was a kind of a distinguishing factor there. So
you would have thought though, in this situation, if she did have a balanced translocation, you would have thought with that many, you would have picked it up. I had a similar situation where I had a patient that had about 40 eggs.
Well, but with only three embryos, not necessarily.
Three normal. We don't know how many fertilized.
Oh, okay.
I had one that had about 40 eggs and great fertilization, great embryo development. We had a bunch to test and there was one normal and there was a whole bunch that I forgot what it was, but you could tell there was missing in one embryo in addition to that. So you knew it was a balanced translocation.
Yeah, it was a parallel.
So I've had a patient like this that, and I know not all of us are on the same page with DNA fragmentation and however you want to treat DNA fragmentation, but I've had somebody that was in a similar situation. We end up having a better run after addressing the DNA fragmentation for that particular couple. But like you guys said, I think it depends on what your family goals are. And remember, nothing happens when people sing happy birthday to you. It's not like magically you are different today than you were yesterday. It's just that time isn't your friend. So, you know, if you have two embryos and you ideally want to have two or three children, I would say absolutely, if you can, within your means, do another egg retrieval, I would try to do that. But it just kind of depends on what your end goals are.
Yeah, I would agree with that as well. There's no fertility cliff at the age of 35 that you all of a sudden fall off of. But, you know, if you know you're going to want more kids than you currently have embryos, then get them now because you have nothing to lose.
Within our lab, day seven embryos just tend not to do quite as well as day five or six. I usually consider day five or six embryos relatively equal. And day seven, I mean, I still get babies out of day seven embryos, but I think it is a lesser pregnancy rate.
Yeah, it took longer time to get to the same point where all the other embryos are. All right. So Daniel, we are very excited to talk with you today because you have been in the fertility space for so long that one of the things that we wanted to talk about was what's out there on the horizon. Like what new and exciting things are potentially out and about and coming that will impact our patients. And so wanted to know what you thought about that.
Great. I love it. I'll give you a little context of why I'm in this space. And it's because a few years back, I was part of the founding team for a company called Give Legacy, givelegacy.com, legacy. And what we did was facilitated sperm freezing from home. So we would ship a small little box, the man would do their thing at home, and then ship it back to one of our labs. We'd analyze it, and then we'd cryopreserve it. With that company, we started from scratch and built it all the way up to financing. The company's still running. And in that process, I got to meet a lot of people in the industry, a lot of exciting new ideas coming up, as well as the execution of those ideas, which are now companies. And I'll divide it by buckets because you have consumer, which is what I was doing. So, you know, opening up the fertility space to everyone and anyone. And you have companies like Modern Fertility, It's hormone testing from home. And in that space, I would put, you know, legacy as well for the male side of things, as well as fellow, which is focusing more on the clinical side. And, you know, companies like Roman, Roe, which was erectile dysfunction, getting into the space by acquiring Modern Fertility. But then what's coming, and you're doctors here, you talk about outcomes, and it's all about outcomes in this industry.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Cost and outcome are the two biggest things we talk about.
Mm-hmm. And those two, I would say, are also part of my passion, especially with access. Cost is such a big deal, especially here in the US, that anything that we can do to help reduce those costs will make a huge difference. But we have now all these words, you know, machine learning and artificial intelligence and all these other things coming up. I think one of the big breakthroughs that we're going to see is in artificial intelligence. And you have now companies developing software that will be able to help us determine if an egg is better, if a sperm, a small sperm, the smallest cell in the body, correct, is better, or an embryo is better. So they will help, they will augment the lab technicians, the embryologists, lab directors, in choosing the best sperm, the best egg, and the best embryo. And with this, you have companies like Future Fertility in Canada. They're specializing in egg, and they're also coming up with a way to determine when is the best time to transfer the embryo by looking at the uterine lining. Then you also have companies like Life Whisper, which looks at the embryo and says, oh, look, this is a better embryo. And we as humans might see just the same embryo under the microscope, but when a machine looks at it, it thinks, huh, this one's better, even if they look the same.
Let's break this down. Let's break this down. So, I'm like, I want to dive into this a little bit more. Okay, so to me, eggs are almost, I don't know, it's one of those things that I'm like, we have a limited number of eggs that we get in our egg retrieval. Great to know which one's the best, but I really think that, in my opinion, which embryo is the best is really more useful, because even if you have an egg that doesn't look so good, it's not like you're not going to inseminate it unless you're in one of those situations where somebody ethically, morally, religiously won't do
more than one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in a situation like you're in Italy and you can only inseminate, you know, one or two eggs, definitely see the purpose in that technology. But like, what type of things are they using to like identify on a sperm other than shape, make sure it doesn't have two heads, two tails, it's not misshapen, whatever. Like, what are they looking at when they're looking at an individual sperm to say, you are the most handsomest of all?
Yeah. So actually that's really cool. And I'm going to say I'm lucky because I'm one of the few that has seen the algorithm at work, and it's almost gamified. So what I mean by that is they overlay this really cool thing on top of all the little sperm swimming in real time. And, you know, as humans, we can only look at four sperm at the same time. The machine can look at all of them at the same time in this field of view.
And they track them, so you know where it is?
And they track them. And then they tell you, this one is the best one. And then you got to go and get it.
Oh, my goodness.
So,
wow.
That really ups the game on who your andrologist is.
Yeah.
The second question is, how do you actually get that one sperm that you know is the best one?
You leave it to the andrologist. They're pretty good at it.
It kind of, when you said that, Daniel, it kind of reminds me, my son is majoring in sports analytics. And so part of analytics in sports is to pick the diamond in the rough, the outfielder. Yes. That may not be the best outfielder, but he takes the most direct path to catch the ball, or he has a certain spin on the ball that nobody else has that's better. And it's kind of the same with sperm. It's like you're trying to track and how quickly they swim and where they swim and if they swim on target. And
yes.
So how are they able to collect all this data? Because you are inherently limited when you're looking at it of, you know, yes, there's 85 zillion, not really, you know, let's say a more conservative 80 million sperm in the course of a sample. And even if you have those 80 million sperm, like, okay, you can say these are the best 1%. But you still don't have thousands upon thousands of eggs to practice on. So you really got to narrow it down. And how can you, how can you say that makes a difference in testing?
Are they basing it on like speed and like how straight they're going?
And morphology, like are they picking up actual measurements and saying, okay, the ratio of length to width of the head of the sperm is, you know, XYZ, and it really needs to be ABC. And so we're going to go with this set instead of the others. Like, how, what criteria are they using?
So this is going to be more of a guess, but I'm going to say yes to all your questions, all of them, because I don't know exactly.
But the beauty of it is the machine can do all that, though. It's kind of like when Mike Snyder talked to us about, you know, about genes and getting big data and taking big data to synthesize it down to pick out the best one. It sounds like that's what they're kind of doing. They can monitor all those things.
Exactly. And then they can input and change those criteria pretty quickly. So if they're starting to get data back on, you know, this criteria is actually having a higher effect on the outcomes, then we can ump that one up, say this one's going to be more important or this one's going to be less important. And in a way, that's why I call it augmenting the andrologist, because at the end of the day, the one that makes, the person that makes the decision is the andrologist. The machine only tells you, look, this one might be better. Same with the embryos. Like, this rating is better. Which one are you going to transfer at the end of the day? Whichever one the patient wants. But the suggestion is there.
Okay, so onto embryos a little bit. So when you're talking about this technology, is this something that's looking at physical morphology of embryos, something that's watching the embryos as they've been growing, or is it something that we're actually testing the embryos, or a combination of thereof?
Wow. So actually, I think there's a lot in that question that we need to unpack, because now we're no longer talking about one company, but multiple companies. And now we're seeing, as you know, non-invasive PGT testing coming into the market. And that's one unbelievable technology, because we're taking the stress away from the embryo at the time of testing.
But we need to have the same reliability of what we're getting from testing that embryo.
Exactly. And that's, if you think about PGT, it started as PGD, diagnostic. And now it's just a tool. It's just testing. So it's going to be the same here. We're going to start developing these technologies. And this might be a little unconventional, but may I ask the three of you a question about new technologies? Because I've been on this side, which is, wow, all these new technologies are coming up. But I'd like to know from your end, how do you determine when a technology is ready to be offered to a patient? When is it, you know, valuable to show it to the patient, to bring it to the bedside?
Well, I'm thinking when you said that, it made me think of the biggest change one of the bigger changes we've made in the past several years is to decide to freeze all the embryos and do testing, PGT testing, and then transfer them to the patient and genetically test them. And honestly, we saw in one of our groups, even our youngest group, there's a significant bump in pregnancy rate from like 50 to 65, 70% chance of pregnancy. And I think in our field, we're always hesitant to adopt new technology because generally most of what we adopt is not looked at or vetted in a randomized prospective study. And so it's really nerve-wracking to make such a big decision and recommend it to a patient, particularly when they're paying out of pocket for it, if we don't have data to back it up. So in my mind, at least me personally, to adopt something new, I feel like I have to have some sort of data to back it up before I can just go, oh, the computer says that morphologically this embryo is prettier, so therefore this is the one we need to transfer. I would want some sort of data to tell me that it's the right thing to do first.
What do you think, Susan?
I don't want to be necessarily the first one doing something. I probably tend to be a like mid-range to early adopter. I'm usually not towards the end. You know, there has to be some data behind it. I have to say, most of the time when I've been introduced to a new technology, a lot of times it's because there's a patient tied to it. And I actually experienced this like 2 weeks ago. So there is something new on the horizon, something called PGTP. And one of my colleagues in our clinic has been talking about it a little bit, saying, hey, we need to, you know, be looking at this. And I get on this new patient consult and they're like, we have a strong history, family history of melanoma, which melanoma is a form of skin cancer. And there's a genetic predisposition towards it. But obviously, sun exposure, skin tone, all those things kind of play into it. And they're like, we want to do blank because of this. And we've talked to somebody at this particular company who does this type of technology. And they said that you're going to be able to help me. I'm like, Okay, let's kind of dive into this and get more information and really start to understand more behind the science. And this particular couple has a very specific need that is going to let me, this is going to be my first PGTP case, and it's going to be a learning experience, but it's neat, like looking at it. I mean, and like I said, there's really nothing else to help this couple when they're trying to target this one specific thing for their family. And I understand it. This particular family has had a lot of, you know, health problems and deaths and the comorbidities that go around with melanoma. And I understand their desire to do this. And I don't think it's an unreasonable thing as long as they understand kind of the pros and cons. All of these forms of tests have pros and cons. None of them are perfect. No test is perfect. No machine is perfect. No person is perfect. But with those understandings, kind of understanding the world that it can open up as well.
I think that I would agree, like I'm unlikely to be the very first to adopt something, but I think we tend to vet a fair number of ideas on a pretty regular basis. I think the actual institution of a new idea, concept, whatever, in part is going to be based on very real criteria of I'm much more likely to adopt something that's a $100 innovation rather than a $100,000 innovation. And especially when you start talking about AI, $100,000 is not really that unreasonable of a number. And so it requires a significant outlay of funds up front in order to get that technology. And so you don't want to wait for, you know, all of the data to be in, because that means that you're probably pretty far behind. However, at the same time, you want to have enough data to say, yes, this is worth bringing in this technology, because, you know, ultimately it's usually the patient who is paying for it. And we are the gatekeepers of that. And what we do is expensive at baseline because of the sheer number of man hours and technology required just to get the embryo, much less whatever testing we do on it. And so yeah, it's a very tough thing. I mean, that's why we go to the annual meetings. That's why we get all the journals every month, and we do podcasts like this and bring people like you on so that we get exposed to more ideas earlier and hear things that kind of nudge in one direction or the other. Like, okay, this makes sense. It's achievable. And this is what the end goal is going to be. Because I think one of the things that a lot of us as docs get hung up on is the theory behind the basic science is phenomenal. But if you can't put it into action and you see a tangible benefit, like, great, we can figure out which eggs are the best. Well, you know, that's several steps removed from being able to get eggs that are better when you're just working with what you're given. And so it's, you know, it's kind of the divide between the clinical sciences and the basic sciences. The basic sciences, they're really good about pulling up that very preliminary information. And the clinical sciences, it's more about show me the money. Like, how is this going to help my patient?
Well, and I think the other thing too, we need to get the buy-in of the patient, because freezing embryos, for example, I go back to that example, freezing embryos and transferring them 6 weeks later, in my mind, I thought there is no way, no matter how good the science is, that I'm ever going to be able to talk a patient into, you know, waiting another 6 weeks to transfer an embryo when we were used to transferring embryos 3 to 5 days after they were created. And so that's one of the good benefits of the internet is the internet kind of, you know, people started looking on the internet and realizing that doing a frozen transfer was better than a fresh transfer. And a lot of people focused on the freezing and the thawing part instead of the data that we get because we freeze and we're able to test the embryo genetically and then transfer it. But nevertheless, people started coming to us going, you know, I think I want to do this frozen embryo transfer thing instead of doing a fresh transfer. And so that really kind of speeded things up a little bit, I think, with that particular situation. So buy-in of the patients is really important too.
I love it. Thank you for all those answers.
I feel like our podcast has been turned on upside down here. Now we're being interviewed instead of us interviewing the person, our guest. So, hey, this is cool, Daniel. I don't think we've ever done this before.
What made you ask that question, Daniel?
Well, number one is having grown up in this industry. And when I say grown up, I literally was raised by a fertility specialist. So, you know, for all of you out there, I saw the beginnings of the fertility industry, and I lived through it all the way into, you know, when I started my career in it.
Where were you raised, Daniel?
In Colombia. So I'm Colombian, born and raised.
Okay. You had a fertility doctor parent. Interesting.
Yes. Jose Ignacio Madero. That's my dad. Legend. But so I asked this question because I early on got interested in health overall. And what I realized is that the fertility industry is one of those few that really takes up on new technology. And we have seen the outcomes jump significantly over the past, I'm going to say 30 years, and then we can say the same for the past 20 years, and then we can say the same for the past 10 years. Now, I asked that question because it's been all of you taking up this technology. And it's, you know, from an industry perspective, hats off, because the results are there and all patients have seen these results. You know, someone trying to go through IVF 25 years ago had a fraction of the chance of someone going through IVF right now.
So 20 years ago, when I was trying to have my son, best case scenario was a 30% pregnancy rate in the youngest patients. The best fertility, we didn't have AMH back then, but you know, the ones we thought that were the most fertile, now it's 70%. So in my 20-year career, it's flip-flopped, which is really interesting to me.
Yes.
And my IVF baby, who just turned 11, I literally like flew across the country to, because it was when PGTA was relatively new and I wanted to kind of go to like the place to get the best of the best. Whereas now I'm like, I can't even imagine a fertility clinic not offering PGTA, which I know there's some of them, but there aren't a lot of them that don't offer it at all.
So Susan, do you remember what the pregnancy rates were without PGTA versus with PGTA? What did they quote? Do you remember what they quoted you?
I don't remember what they quoted me.
Okay.
So yeah, that's why I asked the question. It's more because I've seen it and the adoption of new technologies is part of my fascination. So, you know, translational medicine, translating, you know, the science into the patient bedside. So I love that. And that's in part why I got into it. Not in the clinical side, by the way. I've always been on the back office, on the business side of things. But with all your answers, I think, you know, we can unpack so many different things. Just genetics. What we're seeing today is pre-implantation and then preconception genetics. So there's a company now called Orchid Health, who's doing panels for both parents and is looking at a lot of things and can now predict what those embryos might carry. So it's we're also starting to go way before the lab, way before the consult. We're now going into the planning stages.
I think one of the hardest things is taking that information and getting it from a pure informational standpoint to how does that information help us get our end result that we want?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Connecting the dots and translating it from point A to point Z, because that's what our aim is.
So Daniel, were you at the American Society for Reproductive Medicine this year in Baltimore?
I was.
So were you at the session, and I cannot remember her name, it escapes me at the moment, but she talked about taking skin fibroblast and creating gametes from that. And the next step was not only just an egg from a woman and a sperm from a man, but you could create a sperm from a woman and an egg from a man. Did you hear that talk?
I didn't hear that talk, but I remember seeing the first inroads into this about 8 years ago from... And it came out of Vancouver, and it was only on the male side, which was creating eggs from a man by taking the mitochondria out and placing the male mitochondria in.
Yeah, and this wasn't even that. It was purely going from fibroblasts to gametes.
To me, that is just mind-blowing. And they kind of said, because an ethicist came out and talked later, and it's just mind-blowing to me that they say this technology could be potentially usable in 10 years. And I'm just like, I can't even wrap my mind around that right now. But if you'd asked me, you know, 20 years ago that I'd be able to know if I'm transferring a boy embryo or a girl embryo with normal genetics, I would have thought that was mind-boggling probably too, you know, so.
Not just doing fish where you have the little bright lights for the 3 chromosomes.
Oh, Susan, we didn't have fish back in those days. I'm talking the dark ages. 20 years ago, no fish. We did day three embryo transfers, no genetics, you know. But, and there's not a lot to look at in embryos that are 6 or 8 cells, you know. So, but that's how we made a decision about when to transfer. So what are your thoughts about that, Daniel? Do you think that's really something that's going to be ready for prime time in 10 years?
I would like to bet on it even before 10 years, because now we're also seeing that science is starting to accelerate. The production of science and the translation to the bedside is being accelerated little by little. One of the perfect examples is the vaccine over the past year and a half for COVID. But I would like to think that that might happen even before. But if you think about genetics, now we have CRISPR as well. And now it's, are we going to start messing with the, you know, the germline? That's a different question.
Yeah. CRISPR and gene editing is a whole new horizon.
Well, there's actually a study in Nashville that I've talked about before where it's not in reproductive medicine, but it's a CRISPR trial where women that have sickle cell and beta thalassemia, their stem cells are being re-engineered and they go through a stem cell transplant with new stem cells. And we have patients walking around here that basically are cured from sickle cell anemia and thalassemia. Now, small numbers. I mean, it's a very small study, but
there is an amazing 60 Minutes episode all about that in sickle cell. It is an amazing, I highly recommend, I'm assuming you can like pull it up on YouTube or something, but look up 60 Minutes sickle cell, watch the video. It definitely was one of those videos that will like stick with me for the rest of my life. It was so amazingly moving.
Life altering, because they're getting like a transfusion every month of their life.
Life saving, yeah.
So CRISPR is essentially a technology where we can cut out and replace a certain part of the coding that causes certain diseases to happen, to kind of keep it simple. And using this technology, there's a lot of ethical, moral, social implications and question marks, but in the right hands and in the right situations, it can potentially, like I said, it restored these people to normal lives. And I mean, I can tell you all three of us, I am absolutely certain, has a patient that they treated with sickle cell in their medical school or residency that they will remember for the rest of their lives, because it's unbelievably devastating, crippling diseases that there's so limited access to what we can do to help, and to be able to take somebody from being on narcotics because they can't exist without them because their pain is so severe, to completely normal functioning human beings. It's a blessing of science. It's just absolutely amazing. I mean, you can just see my heart is just like, oh.
I've seen at least two or three patients in that CRISPR trial because we're freezing their eggs. And it's just, I almost cry when I'm talking about it because I'm like, this is so great for you. This is, and we've seen 14 and 15, I mean, young kids, but it's just going to be so, such a great thing for them. So definitely new technology. We have to be really careful about, like you said, the ethical implications and what can happen. But there's just so many good things that can come from that too. And hopefully we'll have the right people making the right decisions to be able to use that technology someday in our field to do more than just checking for the number of chromosomes, to be able to cure illnesses. I mean, that would be fabulous if we could do that even at the embryo stage.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Is there anything else that you can think of that's big, Daniel, that's coming on the horizon that we haven't already talked about? I mean, we talked about sperm, eggs, embryos, genetics. Those are all the big areas, but is there anything else, AI, anything else that you know of or you can think of?
Well, there's one company that I've been following. The reason why is because when we were freezing sperm, we had to think about storage and we had to think about chain of custody and we had to think about all these different things. And today we have seen an explosion in the different services around storage, for example, alarms or inventory systems, specifically for gametes in this case, from embryos, sperm, and eggs. But there's one big company out there that I've been following over the past 3 years called Tomorrow, and it's spelled TMRW. And they're making big inroads in the industry and waves because they've created this huge robot that helps with inventory and chain of custody overall. So you are now seeing people thinking, wait, I want to be able to see where my embryos are, my sperm, my eggs are. You know, this is on the consumer side, but also we're seeing from the clinic side, I don't want that risk anymore. If you ever go to an IVF lab, usually you have doors, which are like these bottle-like fridges that hold liquid nitrogen, where all the different embryos, sperm, and eggs are stored. And they're usually either on a separate room with all these different alarms on, or they are under the tabletops. And that's the way it works. And that's the way it's been. You see over the past 10 years where a whole bunch of these embryos were thawed, and it made a lot of noise in the media because there was a lot of loss of embryos, eggs, sperm. So this company comes in and says, we want to append this part of the industry and we want to really help change it and revolutionize it. And I think they're doing something really cool, which is we created a robot. You're going to be able to see exactly where it is, track from when it comes out of the fridge all the way to the tabletop, who's handling it, when it was frozen, when it was put into the robot, if it was transferred to a different location. So I think this was also a really interesting part of the industry, which is storage, which no one really talks about too much, but it's also getting revolutionized and little by little starting to change. So that I would say in the storage side of things, but I would say we would have to have another complete different podcast just to talk about what's happening in the genetic space. And just to give you, you know, a few companies that I've worked with or I know of, Path Fertility is one that is really cool. They can predict the age of sperm, the biological age of sperm, and they can also determine, you know, the quality overall of sperm samples. Then we have all the different testing that's happening, you know, with iGenomics and all the other ones coming up. Another company that I find very exciting is Overture. They are trying to put the lab into a box, and they're still in production and creating the product, but that's very exciting. It's, can we increase access now to the lab? Is it going to have to be, you know, a $20,000 service that we provide, or can it be something a lot cheaper? And then my favorite part is access, increasing access through benefits. Now you have New York State saying, you know, you need to cover it as an employer. You need to cover fertility to these huge companies like Progyny, Stork Club, Carrot, that are helping and working with those companies to create benefit packages for all their employees. So I think, you know, there's so much that we could talk about. But those are a few of the things that I can think of.
Very interesting.
That's phenomenal. Well, thank you so much for going through all of that with us. There's so many changes, and it's fun to talk to somebody who sees it from a very different perspective than we do, being in the clinical space versus from the higher overview of it. So we are very appreciative that you joined us today. So thank you for that.
No, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed talking to all of you, and I'd be more than happy to be back.
We'd love to have you. It sounds like we have a lot to talk about. It sounds great.
I was going to say, I think we've come up with a half dozen ideas through the course of this episode. So, and to our audience, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to tune in next week for more. Be sure to subscribe, leave us a review in iTunes. We'd love to hear from you. We're also on Instagram and Facebook. So hop on by and leave us a hello or ask a question there.
You can also visit fertilitydocsuncensored.com to submit specific questions you have about infertility. All questions will be answered on the podcast anonymously for the Ask the Doc segment, so don't hold back. We also love episode ideas, so let us know what you are thinking and what you want to hear.
As always, this podcast is intended for entertainment and is not a substitute for medical advice from your own physician. All right, I think that about wraps it up. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
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 Thank you. Bye.
We want to thank Ovation Fertility for sponsoring today's podcast. On the road to parenthood, many of our listeners find themselves in need of fertility testing, IVF, and other related services such as egg donation, genetic testing, or gestational surrogacy. Ovation is a one-stop shop for services that many people may need as they go through fertility care. You can learn more about Ovation services for hopeful parents at ovationfertility.com.